Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulibi. This week on Culturetopia, a new psychological thriller on television, Homeland, centers on a CIA officer obsessed with finding an Al-Qaeda conspiracy. One of the British actors Americans love from The Wire, Idris Elba, returns to his detective role in the brutal BBC America show Luther. And a lost work by Ludwig van Beethoven is newly reconstructed and recently debuted by the renowned Quatuor de Nil String Quartet. But first,
Homeland. It's a psychological espionage thriller that centers on a CIA officer, played by Claire Danes, who hears about a conspiracy when she gets a tip from a terrorist who's about to be executed by the Iraqi government.
You said you were an important man. You said you had information about an attack by Abu Nazir.
I have information.
Prove it.
But as a guard pulls her away, the prisoner whispers something.
Omar's exact words, please.
An American prisoner of war has been turned.
He said this in English.
Yes, he whispered it into my ear right before the guards pulled me away.
I want to use the expression, turned.
He meant turned, working for Abu Nazir.
The series hopes to be as successful as 24, which became popular when the 9/11 attacks were still raw and fresh. Howard Gordon and Alex Gansa, who were writers on 24, produce Homeland, which is actually taken from an Israeli TV series. NPR's counterterrorism correspondent Dina Temple Raston has screened the first three episodes of Homeland. Dina, thanks for being our Roger Ebert.
I'll try to be at that level.
All right. Let's start with the main characters and the plot. Who are the key people that we need to watch?
Basically, the story revolves around three people. The slightly unstable CIA agent that Claire Danes plays, her mentor and boss at the agency, and this prisoner of war, this American prisoner of war, Sergeant Nick Brody. And the premise is basically that this Al-Qaeda-like group has held this Marine for 8 years. They tortured him and may have turned him. So when he returns to the U.S., there's a real question about whether he's a terrorist.
Instead of Kiefer Sutherland playing Jack Bauer, this show features a woman CIA agent. And kind of like Jack Bauer, she has some quirks to work out.
She does. This agent played by Claire Danes is bipolar. Like Jack Bauer, she seems perfectly willing to break rules when it suits her. In the pilot, for example, when her boss refuses to let her put this returning POW under CIA surveillance, she breaks into Sergeant Brody's house and plants all these secret cameras and microphones and wires them up so she can basically watch his every move from monitors she's set up in her own living room. And her boss, a character played by Mandy Patinkin, when he discovers her illegal surveillance, he threatens to report her to the authorities. And in this scene, between Patinkin and Danes, you can hear how the writers are dealing with civil liberties violations and then also dealing with the pall the 9/11 attacks seem to have cast over Claire Danes as well.
I thought that once I had some proof...
You have any? Anything? Even suggesting that Sergeant Brody's what you think he is?
No.
Then get a lawyer. Because you're going to need one when you report to the IG first thing in the morning.
Saul, please.
There isn't anything to say.
I'm just making sure we don't get hit again.
Well, I'm glad someone's looking out for the country, Carrie.
I'm serious. I missed something once before. I can't let that happen again.
It was 10 years ago. Everyone missed something that day.
Everyone's not me.
Of course, they're referring to September 11th, 2001.
Exactly. And it seems clear that the show is going to explore this idea of the guilt that the intelligence community is carrying around, even 10 years later, that we see in real life all the time. For example, a bomber gets on an airplane two Christmases ago with explosives in his underwear, and suddenly we have this proliferation of machines at the airport that are supposed to be able to identify that kind of bomb.
Dina, one of the big issues in 24 was the show's depiction of torture. Some of the characters reviled it. Others essentially said, we will protect this country by any means necessary. What does Homeland depict?
Well, at least in the first three episodes, when it comes to torture, it's always done at the hands of this Al-Qaeda-like group. There's some very graphic scenes of Sergeant Brody's torture, and it's supposed to explain why he might have been turned into a double agent. In one episode, right after Brody returns to the U.S., he's being interviewed about what happened to him, and the interview is interspersed with flashbacks from Brody's time in captivity.
You were beaten.
No!
Yes, torture. That's right. To what end? To what end? What did they want from you? They want you to lose faith.
torture they show does work. But the interesting thing to watch in the future is going to be whether torture will no longer be something the U.S. side uses to get information in the Homeland episodes.
Based on what you've seen, and without giving away any important plot points, I gather the show suggests that an attack is imminent, but no one is sure how or where, or if this former POW character, Sergeant Brody, is even involved.
Exactly. You recall in 24, you always knew there was a dirty bomb or an assassination or some rocket that was going to hit a target. Nothing here is that concrete. This Claire Danes character, the CIA agent, is unstable. So in the back of your mind, you're left wondering if somehow she's cooked up this whole conspiracy in her head. And maybe she's wrong. I mean, the show is written in this way that it's also possible that Brody is a real threat. And she's right. And we don't know for sure. Actually, that's what goes on in many of these cases in this country 10 years after 9/11. The threat has changed. Homegrown terrorism is a concern. We don't know where the threat might be coming from or what the terrorists look like anymore. And it seems like the show is trying to capture that.
And NPR's Dina Temple Raston talking about the new series Homeland, premieres tomorrow night on Showtime. Dina, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
John Luther, the powerful character created by the British actor Idris Elba, is coming back to American television. BBC America is presenting four new episodes of the popular crime drama Luther starting tonight. Luther is a brilliant but out-of-control police detective who specializes in getting inside the minds of serial killers. The last season ended with a lot of gunfire, the murder of Luther's wife, quickly followed by the murder of the man who killed her. This season begins with John Luther sidelined. He's under investigation by his own police department. In this scene, two characters are discussing Luther and his involvement in the death of his wife's killer.
Tell me about Ian Reid.
It was a friend who betrayed John and hurt him very badly. So I killed him. Two barrels of his own shotgun. Boom, boom.
And did John, and this is very important, Alice, did John ask you to do this?
Good heavens, no.
To help solve that mystery and explain the conundrum of John Luther, we turn to NPR's Linda Wertheimer.
That woman who sweetly says, "So I killed him," that's Alice. Played by Ruth Wilson, she's a psychopath and a killer. But Alice sets up the powerful conflict of this series, that Luther is bathed in violence, that he's surrounded by evil, perhaps corrupted by the killers he's hunting. Still, in the climactic episode of season one, it is Luther who's trying to save the life of his wife's murderer.
Stop! Stop!
Okay, listen! Ian, stop, Mark. I know how much you want to see him die, but don't do it!
I mean, she had a few good rides left in her.
Do it, do it, do it!
No! 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 No!
Two barrels of a shotgun, boom, boom. Idris Elba plays Luther as a moral man who's close to the edge.
Luther has this very sort of capability to think how, you know, his, you know, perpetrators are thinking, what they may or may not do next. And I think also with Luther, he lives quite close to rage himself. You know, the difference between someone with a conscience and someone with not is that, you know, one person will say, you know what? No, I'm not going to go over to that person and smash them in the face. But the other person is quite close to that decision without any remorse and just will do it. And I think Luther is close to that mark all the time.
I must say that I think these programs are very intense. I watched the first season over again to prepare for this conversation, and a couple of times I just had to turn it off and wait for my husband to get home. I needed backup to watch it.
Really?
Yeah.
The idea is it is a very dark show, and we want to push that intensity, but did you really get scared?
Yes. Hmm. I mean, I don't get scared by the don't open that door kind of things. But this one scared me.
Hmm. You're not the only one, by the way. But I couldn't work that out.
Idris Elba's Luther has a little touch of Lucifer in him, a fallen angel who longs to be close to God. He tries to do the right thing. This series is frightening and violent and very, very good. Elba is always center stage, as he was in the role most Americans will remember, the villain he played in The Wire, the drug dealer, Stringer Bell. It did not begin as a starring role, but Elba stole every scene he was in. He says he didn't think of Stringer Bell as being a black drug dealer, but as a complicated man.
I didn't come to America to play black roles. I just came to play roles. And Stringer Bell, being my first character, was a smart drug dealer who, in my opinion, is black, but that's not the point. The point is this is a man that's sort of caught between two worlds, and that complex sort of balance that he's in is what made the drama.
Quiet, cool, and completely ruthless, Stringer Bell tries to put Baltimore's drug traffic on a sound business footing. With death and destruction just a cost of doing business, he conducts meetings with his dealers according to Robert's rules, and in this chilling scene from The Wire, he's clearly setting up a war with his rivals.
Nah, man, we done worrying about territory, man, what corner we got, what project. Game ain't about that no more. It's about product. Yeah. We got the best damn product, so we gonna sell no matter where we are, right? Chair recognized Slim Charles.
That black American accent with overtones of Baltimore took Idris Elba a while to learn. He says he went to the auditions for the part in character and did not tell the directors that he's British, born and raised in London's East End.
The directors and producers were very clear that they didn't want anyone that could be deemed as acting fake. They really wanted those characters in The Wire to be as real as and authentic as they can. So they got actors that had little experience, actors that actually, you know, hadn't done much before. And they got natives, Baltimoreans and such. And so, you know, the casting director, Alexa Fogle, just was very clear that, you know, when you go there, just don't tell them you're English. Yeah. Not yet. Don't do that. And she took a risk because it was clear that was not what they wanted.
Idris Elba says the role he dreams of playing is Nelson Mandela, the leader of South Africa's revolution, another complicated man. I also asked Elba about the story often repeated that he might one day play James Bond, which would, of course, involve an entirely different, presumably posh, accent.
It's a rumor.
Yeah.
It's a very old rumor. My dad and I were talking about this the other day because he says, yeah, you could do it. Why would you do it? I was like, I would do it, but I just don't want to be called the first black James Bond. Although, do you understand what I'm saying? Because that's not, you know, Sean Connery wasn't the Scottish James Bond and Daniel Craig wasn't the blue-eyed James Bond. So if I played him, I don't want to be called the black James Bond.
Mm-hmm.
So, but listen, you know, if Sony decided to call me and say, hey, we want you to do it, you know, I'd definitely consider it.
You'd get in a cab and go right over and have a talk?
I'd not only get in the cab, but I'll take the taxi driver out of the car, hostage the taxi, jump out while it was moving, jump onto a pedal bike that was just coming, you know, just past the door as I got on it, and then get onto a plane on the wing, land on top of Sony Studios, slide through the air conditioning and land in the office.
Well, I hope that you have that opportunity and don't hurt yourself.
I'm never shaken or stirred.
Idris Elba, the second season of his series Luther starts tonight on BBC America. I wouldn't watch it alone. Linda Wertheimer, NPR News.
Time now for our movie critic Bob Mondello's latest home video recommendation. Today, he's spotlighting a widescreen 1950s epic that was specifically designed to drag people away from their TV sets, Ben-Hur.
Everything about Ben-Hur was big, really big. The sound was stereophonic, which was still fairly new back then. The screen wider than all outdoors, and that chariot race, enormous. And though there's more to the film than that one famous scene, let's start there, with Charlton Heston on the commentaries busting what he calls three chariot race myths.
One is that there's a red Ferrari parked in the side of the arena. Not true. Two, that someone was killed in it. Not true. And three, that I am visibly wearing a wristwatch in one or two shots. Now, of course, since I have leather gauntlets to the elbow, that clearly is not true. But it is indeed true. It was a fixed race. I knew I was going to win.
This Blu-ray boxed set, which is itself huge, with picture book and full-color reproduction of a journal Charlton Heston kept on the set, is being billed as the 50th anniversary edition, but you'll note it's been 52 years since 1959. Like its hero, Ben-Hur's getting back a little late.
I will pray that you live till I return.
Return?
The delay is because a $1 million digital restoration took longer than expected, but was worth it. In the making of extras, you'll see clips from the scratchy, washed-out version used for the film's re-releases. Among the goofier extras is a screen test for Leslie Nielsen as Ben-Hur's buddy-turned-nemesis, Missala.
I'm afraid I can't down arrows with much conviction anymore. Met too many charming ladies to go about insulting the god of love.
Think Naked Spear 2.5. Also included, the entire silent 1925 Ben-Hur, so you can see why audiences in the 50s were so psyched about the new one, and why director William Wyler felt he had to make it the biggest, most passionate movie ever.
Kill me and your mother and sister will die today! Nailed to crosses in front of you!
All of which raises the question of whether you really want to watch Ben-Hur on TV, even in high def. There's no question it's not the same as in a movie theater, but with no plans to re-release Ben-Hur in theaters, it's at least better than it would have been in 1959, when ads for mostly black and white TV sets boasted of their giant 24-inch screens. I'm Bob Mondello.
Ludwig van Beethoven was a perfectionist, rewriting and tweaking his works from time to time. For instance, in 1800, he dumped and rewrote the whole second movement of his string quartet in G, Opus 18, number 2, and it came to be the version that's traditionally played today. Most scholars thought Beethoven's original draft was lost. Until now. A music professor from the University of Manchester has reconstructed what he thinks Beethoven's first version might have sounded like. Professor Barry Cooper based his creation on fragments of sketches that Beethoven left behind, mostly a melody line for the higher instruments. And last week, the Quatuor d'Annelle string quartet got to play it. We turned to Vlad Bogdanis, the group's violist, about what it was like.
The lost version is very Beethovenian because it has this very, is very tormented and violent, and it's like a shout. This is something that you don't have in the final version. And somehow it's very typical of Beethoven with all these scales.
We know that Beethoven revised this work, and so what was the sound that we knew?
In this one, you have in the middle section something exciting and happy. And what also is interesting is the in the final version, it took some elements, but then did something totally different. He's a genius, but he's a very different type of genius. He's not like Mozart or Schubert, where they could write without any mistake from the first to the last note. And Beethoven, sometimes you can feel that he was sweating more.
Vlad Bogdanis, he joined us from the BBC studios in Manchester, England. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Musician and producer Sylvia Robinson died today. She was 75 years old and reportedly suffered congestive heart failure. Some may remember Robinson as one half of the duo Mickey and Sylvia. She was also a pioneering producer who played a key role in bringing hip-hop to a general audience. NPR's Netta Ulaby has this remembrance of the woman behind Sugar Hill Records.
Sylvia Robinson was not a rapper herself, but in 1957 she became a star for this sultry duet with Mickey Baker. But after Love is Strange hit the charts, the Harlem-born musician moved to New Jersey with her husband to raise their children. Sylvia and Joe Robinson were ambitious. They built a nightclub favored by boxers and Motown stars and a recording studio where Sylvia Robinson began writing songs for other artists. Al Green rejected one because he found it too sexy, so Robinson sang it herself. Ooh, I don't wanna see. Pillow Talk hit number one on Billboard's Black Singles charts in 1973 and ushered in a wave of music by black women about sexual self-confidence. But legal and financial problems almost bankrupted the couple before Sylvia Robinson attended a birthday party at a club.
And I saw this DJ playing music, and he was saying things to the kids, and they would answer him back. And I says, oh, my God, that's a great idea.
That's Robinson in a VH1 documentary about the history of hip-hop. At the time, the conventional music industry wisdom was that the live energy of rap was impossible to trap on vinyl. Nevertheless, one hot August night in 1979, Sylvia Robinson made her son Joey drive her around Inglewood, New Jersey, looking for rappers. He told NPR in 2000 they went to a pizza place and met Henry Jackson, who became Big Bang Hank.
He's got all this dough on him. He weighs about 350 to 400 pounds at the time. And he jumps in the back of my 98 Oldsmobile and starts rapping.
I'm the dimp, the ladies pimp, the women fight for my delight, but I'm the grand master with the three MCs.
They kept driving around. People kept hopping into the car, and the Sugar Hill Gang was born. Everybody go, hotel, motel, what you gonna do today? None of them had ever worked together before. In the studio, producer Sylvia Robinson cued each one by pointing at them and recorded the single in one uninterrupted 14-minute take. Robinson personally mailed the single to radio stations and badgered them to play it. As Sugar Hill legend has it, tens of thousands of orders soon poured in for the world's first commercial rap single.
Rapper's Delight was a monumental song. It introduced the world to rap and rhyming.
That's MC Grandmaster Caz of the Cold Crush Brothers. But he told NPR in 2004 a lot of New York rappers felt the single misrepresented the scene.
They weren't real MCs. They was just guys out of nowhere that like a group put together to showcase this new music that was going on.
No one could say that about 1982's The Message by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. The seminal, socially conscious rap was produced by Sylvia Robinson.
It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
Robinson fought with her musicians and wound up in vitriolic lawsuits, but none of the rancor overshadows Sylvia Robinson's singularity as a female record producer and a visionary who put rap on the map. Neda Ulubi, NPR News. That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. Culturetopia is produced by Mike Katziff and executive produced by Sarah Saracen. I am Neda Ulubi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.